Welcome to the PA Podcast Series 2. I'm Olivia Coftree, one of the two co-founders of Oriel Partners, a boutique PA and administrative recruitment consultancy based in central London. The business was launched in 2018 with the aim to provide the highest quality of service to both our clients and candidates, following three main values: honest, kind, and fun. Providing an honest and transparent service to our clients, to be kind and helpful to our candidates, and to have fun in the office in a supported working environment. Part of the reason for launching our business was to inspire others, and hence this PA podcast has been launched. This series, I will be interviewing a number of clients across a variety of sectors to provide current industry knowledge, understand what they look for when recruiting, and discuss the skills required to be successful in their roles. Today I'm joined by Amanda Chilcott. Hello. Amanda is the Group HR Director at Neptune Energy. She's had an amazing career. She's got a degree, an MBA, and she's always worked in HR, starting at Ford, Jaguar, Land Rover, 10 years at BP, and more recently over 5 years at Neptune Energy. Neptune's an international oil and gas exploration and production company who have actually just been sold to Eni, who are an Italian-based international oil company. So I'm delighted to have her here. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, lovely to be here.
Thank you for joining. So I thought there's so many things I want to ask you, and I think your role is so interesting to the candidates that we work closely with. But perhaps we could support by going through an overview of your career and how you've got to where you are today.
Really happy to do that. So I had an odd start into HR, actually. When I was growing up, I had no idea what I wanted to be, and everybody I knew worked in the public sector. So I knew dentists and doctors and teachers and nurses. And so I decided I want to be a teacher. And that's what I qualified as a primary teacher. And it was only as I was doing my degree and I would have to go to schools and do my work experience that I realized that I absolutely, definitely did not want to be a primary teacher. And it was a friend at university that said to me, oh, well, you know, why don't you try HR? And I didn't even really know what HR was. But I went for some assessments and Ford Motor Company gave me a role. And I fell into it and I loved it. I just found that I enjoyed the interaction. The people are just foundational. It's every business. The only thing that's really different about it is the people and the culture. Mm-hmm. And being part of that and shaping that, I just found I really enjoyed. And from then, I just went on from company to company in more and more different kind of HR roles, but always in HR roles, sometimes in the UK, sometimes globally. And here I am 20 something years later.
And you've always worked in quite traditionally kind of one thinks of male dominated environments, the cars and then oil and gas.
Yes.
How have you found that?
A really interesting question. I remember vividly when I started working at BP, so obviously a big international oil company. And I was sent for a leadership assessment. And in that leadership assessment, they assessed all sorts of different things and you have to do all sorts of personality tests. And one of the things that they came at the end was that they felt that I had pushed down my emotional intelligence because I was overly focused on kind of being very rational and being very data-driven. And their theory was, because I had worked in such male-dominated industries and therefore perhaps those traits were more dominant and more prominent, that I had tried to fit in with that. Mm. And their advice to me was to say, stop that. There's a big part of what you can bring that you're forcing down, that you're hiding. And actually, you can bring a different perspective if you bring that into your role. And I did try and do that more and more and not be afraid to be the different voice, bringing a different perspective. And it's not to say that all men are data driven and all women are kind of emotionally driven, but, you know, there can be dominant traits. And I learned to be a bit more confident about bringing that out.
And it shows how your environment does rub off on you. Something Amanda told me, I was fascinated hearing about what she does and hearing about the oil rigs. I don't know why, but that just seems like something that I hadn't heard much about historically. And Amanda actually goes to the oil rigs on a helicopter.
Yes.
For often you stay the night.
Yes.
Depending on weather, she says she could stay for a couple of nights. But she's done the training that I don't know if anyone's seen this, where they put the helicopter or a fake helicopter, I assume, in a pool, freezing cold, turn it upside down and hope for the best that you can get out. And I just think that's very admirable, Amanda, that you did that, because that sounds quite scary to a lot of people, I imagine.
You have to do it every 4 years to re-qualify that you can indeed escape from a helicopter that is submerged into the North Sea. Every time I finish the training, and I've always managed to escape, you have to escape 9 times in 9 different scenarios, by which time you're very wet, very cold, because you do the whole thing in a kind of what they call a survival suit. So you've got, you know, boots and shoes and a big set of overalls on. And I always think, well, I'm not sure in real life I would manage to do this, but it is, it gives you a different perspective.
Is it dark?
Yes, yes, you can't see anything.
You're just feeling for the windows.
Mostly you're feeling slightly panicked.
Are there divers in the water?
Yes, there's always 3 divers and they will help you out. I always find that slightly perturbing because I always think, well, why? I wish we didn't need a diver. And I remember the first time that I did it, somebody did get a bit stuck and the divers did have to help them out. And then having to go after that and escape yourself, having somebody kind of struggling and needing to be helped out, didn't fill you with the most the most confidence.
Amanda, very brave, clearly. Okay, so let's go back to Neptune Energy. Tell me about the admin or structure of admin support within Neptune, because I know you have a number of EAs.
We do. We have an absolutely fabulous team of EAs, I have to say. They all work on a kind of 1-to-2 or 1-to-3 relationship, and that's evolved a lot. When I first started working, relationships were 1-to-1, but I think as things have moved on, it's much more normal now that people have a kind of more than one exec that they're serving. And what's fantastic about our group of EAs serving our C-suite is the way that they collaborate together. So if we any big event that we have, any big board meeting, any investor days, they all are there preparing. They are all there on the day making sure it goes right. And we absolutely rely on them. They add a huge amount of value. And the quid pro quo that we try and make sure happens is they get to work on things which are interesting for them. Mm-hmm. So we've got one of our EAs who really is interested in project management. So she's got all of her Prince qualifications. We try to get her involved in that. We've got another one of our EAs who's really kind of technically minded and has done a whole bunch of Microsoft training and is a bit of a kind of master user for many of our systems. And another one of our EAs ran for us single-handedly a global intern program that we put in place, supported all of the recruitment, bringing them on board, all of the events that happened during their internship with us, because she was just really passionate about doing that. And so we tried to involve them in the things that they're interested in, as well as involving them in helping us as an executive team with our daily work.
That is interesting, and that will help retention long term when people are challenged and involved. You mentioned the EAs at C-suite level. Do you have them lower down in the business as well?
To a lesser extent, lower down, we typically tend to have what we would call technical assistants. And they are managing not just the traditional EA work of kind of diaries and events and kind of email and stakeholder engagement, but they will also be doing a lot of data management. You can imagine in an oil and gas company, we have huge amounts of data around production, around our reservoirs, around pressure, and maintaining all of that in a way that meets the regulatory requirements or the requirements of our partners is hugely important. So their role is slightly more different. Technical.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what would you say is the difference or differences about the roles in oil and gas versus other sectors that you've worked in or experienced?
I mean, honestly, I think for me, in as you say, in the sectors I've worked in, they have been broadly similar. But I think the EA role constantly comes down to the same set of core kind of behaviours and characteristics. And I think the best EAs that I've worked with have, it's always been about attitude as much as aptitude, and that drive to do things right, be accurate, collaborate, be adaptable, be flexible, be kind of quick to anticipate, and the ability to be integrated and embedded in the organization, understand what's going on, understand the wider context, to be able to anticipate decisions, anticipate what's needed, is universal. And that's been the same whether it's been the automotive industry, the oil and gas industry, whether it's been kind of, you know, temporary power, which I've worked in as well. It's almost industry agnostic, I think.
I think that's what's so great about the support role, the assistant role, is that you can go from one industry to another. We work at Oriel Partners across all sectors because of that. And in addition to attitude, often we find that the personality fit, especially when you're in one of those one-on-one or one-to-two roles, it is so key. Sometimes I feel a bit more like a matchmaker than anything else, trying to get that right. But if that is right, actually, skills can be learned, especially at senior level. That might be the odd thing they haven't been exposed to. Very quickly to learn, training can be provided, but actually it's the attitude, the 100%. Personality that's going to make that a success. And so what's your hiring process when looking to hire an assistant?
For me, hiring assistants is the hardest role to hire for. It's easier to hire a CEO than it is to hire an assistant.
Wow.
Because I think it's so much, exactly as you say, it's about the chemistry, and it's about the fit with the person that they're supporting. And you can't read that in a CV. Mm-hmm. You can get a feel for, have they worked in similar roles, but you don't really know if they worked for a similar person. And whether they would be a match, therefore, that the person that you're recruiting for. So I preface all of the kind of process with this fact that it is just, for me, the hardest role. We will always try really hard with the person we're hiring for to get them to be very specific about what they are looking for, what's important for them, how do they want to work with this person, what is their access to their kind of their diary and calendar and email that they want to give, what's the flexibility, what's the role that they want this person to play, what are the attributes that they think will fit. And then we will typically always go with somebody like Oriel & Partners, somebody who can help, who knows the candidates and can help us find the right fit. Because if you just put out an ad and people apply with a paper CV, you don't get any of that. And so you waste a huge amount of time interviewing a lot of people when you could have spoken to somebody who knows their candidates and can say to you, if you're looking for this kind of person who would work with this kind of person, then these are the people that you've got.
It's very interesting you mention about going to the person the role is looking to support and finding out exactly what they want and need. Because I think having a clear and defined job spec, or even doesn't need to be a specific spec, we can always put that together, but a very detailed brief is so important. And often where things go wrong is where candidates start a role where they thought they were going to be doing X and they end up doing Y. So I really think that's very important and very helpful with the process. It also allows people doing the interview process to know exactly what they're looking for on behalf of the executive it's supporting. What is your interview process? Do you do video or face-to-face?
We always prefer to do face-to-face. You just get much more of a feel for the person than if you do video. That said, we'll always do a couple of interviews. So we'll always have the HR team do a level of pre-screening first. And if necessary, that will be video. And then the second interview will be with the person or people, often people, that the role is supporting. And that's really where you make the decision, because that's really where you're assessing the kind of fit and feel. I think as also from the candidate's perspective, right? You can equally have a candidate come along and we think they're fantastic, but they haven't got a feel that this is this is going to be a match for them. And we always try and figure out, and again, if you've got a recruitment partner in the middle, it's easier to do that because it's hard for a candidate to say to you, well, actually, I know you want me, but I don't really like you guys. But a middle person
can feedback delicately
and help everybody kind of make a decision that will work for all parties and not one that that one party might regret.
And it's very true in the case of perhaps smaller businesses where they're hiring for the first time or they don't necessarily have an HR structure who are very familiar with the process. We've seen situations where perhaps an outgoing PA is interviewing the potential incoming and that can cause problems, but perhaps the person briefing us hadn't considered that. So it is good having a flow of communication both ways, because as you said, the candidate's got to want the client, but the client's also got to want the candidate. When you're doing your HR round, Amanda, do you competency-based question?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. It tends to be much more of a mix.
Okay.
So we really try and ground it in what is the exec looking for. So if the exec has something that's competency-based that's particularly important for them. So let's say this person wants somebody who is really proficient at managing external investor relations events, and that's a really critical part of the role, then we'll run competency questions around that, because we do want to be sure that this person has got that experience and can cover that aspect. But typically what people are looking for much more is around flexibility, adaptability, the way that this person is going to kind of engage and relate with them. And then it's much more just trying to get behind that person. How do they like to work? You know, what do they look for in the person they're supporting? How do they work with colleagues? And just, again, trying to tease out who that person is.
Okay. Yeah. Anything on CVs you particularly look out for?
To be honest, this is where I come back to, it's such a hard role to recruit for, and I find CVs incredibly unhelpful. What's much more helpful to me is I can sit down with the recruitment partner and say to them, tell me about these people. So it's not to say people shouldn't do CVs. You do need a CV, and a recruiter needs to look at a CV to have a picture of what you've done. But for this role in particular, I personally don't find them super helpful, because they just describe what somebody has done, and the how they've done it is much more important for this.
That's interesting. Because we spend so much time on CVs as a recruitment agency and as candidates ensuring that they're perfect, and they need to be perfect because they're an introduction. They open the door, and then from that, hopefully a discussion can come. But we talk a lot about how important it is for them to be concise and accurate and no spelling mistakes, and I think that still maintains vital to get to the point of being introduced and getting an interview.
Yes. I think one other thing, in the last podcast of your last series, what you also talked about was letting personality come through in the CV. And I think that's really important. I think you can, you know, there must be no spelling mistakes. They must be well laid out. That gives an indication of the care and attention that you give to your work. But they shouldn't be over finessed to the extent that your personality disappears, because that's so important.
And I often think the interests become such a good talking point at that interview. And especially if there's an interest there that the person interviewing you also has.
Yes.
And actually, you probably will end up talking half the interview on those things. But it's good to have those talking points. And as Amanda said, it brings you to life a little bit. So once a candidate is interviewed and they join the firm, they've received an offer, what is your onboarding process? Do you have training?
Yes, well, this is perhaps quite interesting and perhaps unique to the oil and gas industry. So we will do all of the regular kind of orientation. So there'll be a whole bunch of administrative paperwork to make sure that everything is set up correctly. There'll be the typical kind of office tour. We'll introduce people to our systems and our processes, make sure they understand the organisation. But critically for our executive assistants, they also have a role to play in what we call emergency response. So clearly, a large proportion of our workforce are working offshore on oil and gas platforms, and they are dangerous places to work. You've got live hydrocarbons flowing through pipes. Unfortunately, there's always a possibility that they can escape. We always say hydrocarbons are always looking to escape from their pipe, and then you only need an ignition source to have a kind of major fire and explosion, and then you've got a small platform on fire, God forbid, with a lot of people on there whose only way of escape is through lifeboats or a helicopter. So we have very well established emergency response procedures at every level of the organisation so that the organisation can respond immediately in the case of an incident. And we practice three or four times a year. We'll practice those responses, and often we'll have the lifeboats and the police playing along with us. And we'll act out, and we'll spend a whole day kind of practicing our roles. And our executive assistants have a critical role to play, because at the tier four level, which is the highest level of the response, where you're managing the strategy, the long-term planning related to that, they are the administrator, the note taker for that group. And so they have to also learn how to use that system, how to pull out the log data, how to record all of that information, which will then be used later on to make sure that we've kind of complied with all our regulatory responsibilities. So that's a big part of the training. And you obviously never want to have to use it for real, but in your career you'll have to. I've been involved in many emergency response exercises in my time in oil and gas, some kind of awful and tragic and some very positive and uplifting. But you hugely value the training when push comes to shove and you have to put it into action.
And it's a learning experience even if you don't use it.
It is, yeah.
So how far are the oil platforms out from in the sea?
It ranges massively. So if we do it by kind of how many minutes on the helicopter, which is the way I always try to measure it, the ones that are closest to shore are just a 15 to 20 minute ride in the helicopter. So our platform in Norway is that close. The furthest from shore that we have in Neptune is about 45 minutes on the helicopter. But at other companies where I've worked at, it's been an hour and a half. And then my top tip is always to make sure you go to the bathroom before you get on the helicopter, because it's a long time
and if you need to go. On board.
No.
How interesting. Okay, so very unique onboarding process if you go into that sector. How fascinating. And what about longer term opportunities for PAs? Have you had experiences of PAs moving into different roles or areas within a business?
Yes. So three examples come to mind, actually. So in Neptune, one of our PAs loved event management, and she was actually supporting our corporate affairs team. And she got more and more involved in that, to the point at which she evolved and went into their team in a communications advisory role. So picking up internal communications, lots and lots of big event management externally and internally, which was just perfectly suited to her. Another PA kind of back a while in my career had just big kind of aspirations to work for herself. And credit to her, she took the plunge perhaps when she was kind of 15 or 20 years into her career. And she now works as an independent consultant. And I'm sure you've heard of this business where you match colours and you help people think about the colours that suit you.
Yes.
And work best on you. And that's what she does full time now.
It's like a stylist.
That's right. And she's going great guns. And I mean, she'll just be perfect about it, because she just has the personality to kind of help people just feel great about themselves and see themselves differently. And then we had another PA who left us and went to work in education.
Okay.
So she's now working in a primary school. Yeah.
I always love hearing of the kind of success stories of people who've gone on to do different things, because I think it's nice to know with any career that you're not always stuck in that same role forever, that there's not only progressions within the role, but outside of it too. And if you're in an organisation large enough that has the capabilities, usually talent is supported. It's nurtured, but supported. And so it's really nice to hear of situations like the lady that went on to work in events, that those options are available. Let's go back to someone at the start of their career.
Yeah.
Do you have advice for someone starting their career and wanting to become a PA?
I think the best way to get started is typically to come in through something like reception, team assistant, office management. You need to get that kind of core experience before you can get in a one-to-one or one-to-two relationship. Mm-hmm. And I think that they are great roles to learn how to interact with a whole bunch of different people, which is so important. You are the face of the organization for so many of our stakeholders. And so learning how to do that in a safe environment where it's not so mission critical really helps. You also learn to juggle multiple competing priorities if you're a team assistant, if you're a receptionist, if you're an office manager. And that's such a critical part of a PA's ability to be able to have that adaptability and the flexibility. And I think once you're in those roles, then it's really easy to spot the talent. Mm-hmm. And once you've got credibility within the organization, it's much easier then to say, hey, I would like to then build my career into a more personal service that's being provided. So I think that's just a great place to start.
I agree. And in those reception roles, you get so much face time with every level within a business because you're at the front door often where everyone's coming in and people will notice you. And I think actually, if you want to be known, to be seen, and that could potentially then lead to other things. Yeah. It's a great first role.
A great example of that actually is, you mentioned at the beginning, we've just been bought by by Eni, and our receptionist just happens to be Italian. Mm-hmm. And so all of the executives coming in now to kind of get to know Neptune and think about how we integrate are Italian from Italy. And so Kat is just having the most amazing time because of, they are just so delighted to find that the first person they meet is fluent in Italian.
Yes, and what a welcome.
Yes, no, it's just so fortuitous. And for Kat, I mean, just a great way for her to make a fantastic impact.
But I do think your first job is often the hardest one you'll ever make or ever secure, because you're coming to the table with very little experience. And so something we always try and encourage, if you're in a position to do it, is temping. It can be a really fantastic way to build up that experience. And even if it's a really basic role, which perhaps isn't as fulfilling as you'd like, it's giving you money, but also it's giving you an opportunity to get a reference and showing that you can come into work on time and do the job given to you. And even if it's not something you enjoy, it in a way allows you to work out what you do enjoy. Yeah. And that therefore is then a positive experience. And when someone asks you at interview, why do you want us? You can say, well, I did temping here and I felt it wasn't right, or temping here. And it just gives you more to talk about, which I think, when you're competing against a lot of other graduates or people who've come out of education, it gives you that extra bit to stand out. So the more you've got to talk about on your CV, or the more experience you have, always the most helpful.
My current EA is actually a great example of that. So she was temping as a receptionist in a company that I wasn't working at the time. I joined that company, and she was she had just been pulled out of her temp receptionist role and kind of made a temp PA. And I was one of the people that she was supporting. And the chemistry was just perfect. I mean, hands down perfect. And we got along so well immediately. And when I left that company to join Neptune Energy, I went back to ask her to come with me, which thankfully she did. And so then she's been my EA as I've worked in that C-suite role, which all came from that original temping experience.
How long have you had your EA?
So we've now been working together for maybe 8 years. I think she is the person, I've never worked with anybody for as long in duration of time as I have with her, because the match is just great. And she knows me and she anticipates me. And of course, you know, I know her and I know how she works and how to get the best out of her. And it's just, it's
a successful,
just been a wonderful story. Yeah,
that's so nice. I love seeing PAs who move businesses with their bosses, because it shows A, how reliant their boss is on them.
Yes.
What a good relationship that must be. It's always so nice to see. And actually something your assistant does, Amanda, which is relevant to my next question, was about working from home.
Yes.
I'm right in thinking she works from home a lot. And I think that's particularly challenging sometimes when joining a new business. So you at Neptune, you have a working from home policy, I think.
Yes, fairly flexible one.
Fairly flexible. What's your advice to succeed in doing that?
I think working from home is, I think if you start a company and you immediately work from home, that's incredibly hard. I think your ability to get to know the organisation and get to know people is really limited by that, because there's a lot of what you pick up about the culture, the way things get done, where relationships are working, where they're not working, how to create influence. You pick up at the coffee machine or when you're chatting to somebody as they pass
overhearing the conversations.
And you just don't get that when your interactions are wholly virtual in nature. So if it's possible, my advice would always be to get office time, especially at the beginning, until you've figured out those dynamics and figured out how to work them. And if that's not possible because the organization you're working for is kind of very into working from home, to try and avoid all of your virtual interactions being transactional and try and pick up, you know, where relationships are good, how work gets done, who's linked to who, so that at least you build that mental map of things, which just comes so automatically if you're in the office together. My EA works wholly from home now because she, as part of her personal life, she moved from London to the north of England. And I was prepared to do anything to hang on to her. So I was really happy to arrange a flexible arrangement. She comes to the office usually about once a month. She will always come if there's a big event going on. We still speak 3 times a week the way that we always have done. And then lots of informal, unscheduled kind of chats in between that to get things done. But because we know each other so well.
Yes, and you've had the FaceTime historically.
Then it absolutely works.
That's good to hear. Okay, that wraps up my questions for you, Amanda, but I have to give you the opportunity to ask me something, which one of the ladies that I interviewed at the start of this series started. So is there anything you'd like to ask me? And I hasten to add, this is completely unprepared.
There is, and it's completely unrelated to anything we've talked about,
good.
But I think it's a question somebody asked me once. And I think it's a very relevant given we're in a recording studio. And it's to say, do you remember what was the first live band that you ever went to see? And who was it? And what do you remember about that first formative experience?
Oh, do you know what, Amanda? I have to be honest, I'm not sure I've seen many live bands in my life.
Are you covering up an embarrassing one?
Absolutely not. My dream would have been to see the Spice Girls. Do you know what? Let me think. So I did a lot of going to musical theatre when I was younger. When I was at university, I was in the group, I don't know what the society, the Musical Appreciation Society, and they used to take us up to London to see lots of shows. So I feel like I saw a lot of West End musicals more than anything else.
What was your favourite?
Wicked.
Was it?
I've seen it 3 times.
That's impressive.
And actually, at Oriel Partners, we still do summer or winter party. We try and do one at least to the West End show. But I am going to see ABBA Voyage imminently. So I will be able to comment on that one. But yeah, West End shows are more my thing. Have you been to see some live?
When the person asked me, I was quite, mine is a slightly odd one because it makes me sound much older than I am, I hasten to say. But the first band I saw was Pink Floyd, which was a bit influenced by my father and his tastes. And I remember feeling very young. I think I was about 14 years old, and I got the coach up to London and being surrounded by a lot of older bearded men and not finding it quite the experience I was expecting. But when I asked somebody once, their first person had been Elvis,
which
I thought was just absolutely incredible. Yeah.
Maybe I need to do more of this.
Yeah.
Definitely. Well, Amanda, it's been such a pleasure speaking to you today. Thank you so much
Thank
for coming
you.
On the podcast. I think it's been really interesting and we'll speak to you soon.
Lovely. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to the Oriel Partners PA podcast. I hope you found this informative and inspiring. If you are looking for a new PA role or know of anyone else who might be, or are looking to hire, please do get in touch and we would love to help. The web address is orielpartners.co.uk and our office number is 0207 101 9229.